Brexit, an independence referendum in Scotland, and the rise of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, this past decade in British politics has been both tumultuous and fascinating. On this episode of In Focus, we cross the pond. I'm joined by Kieran Pedley, Director of Politics at UK polling firm Ipsos Mori. Kieran is also the host and editor of the Polling Matters podcast. We are going to explore Vox Britannia, how public opinion has shifted over the past few years in the UK, and how it helps to explain some historic events that will no doubt shape British politics for years to come. Kieran has been doing research and commentating on polls and politics in the UK for years, and our conversation takes us from general elections to Brexit to the Scottish independence referendum. Here's my conversation with Kieran Pedley. In the same boat as me as a relatively young public opinion researcher, you've got your own podcast, which I listen to regularly, followed it closely, particularly over the number of general elections you've had over the last few years. But I've been starting most of the conversations on this podcast with practitioners of public opinion research by asking, what is your kind of overarching framework or philosophy when studying or analyzing public opinion?
So, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's great to be with you. I admire the work you do. I'm not sure I have an overarching sort of philosophy, like a Pedley doctrine or something, you know, that I follow. But that said, there are a few principles that I think are important when you're looking at public opinion. And I suppose the first one is that, as in any academic pursuit, really, is what is the quality of the material that you're looking at. So you want to ask, you know, is the source of data reputable? Do I think the data is reliable? Like, do I trust the sampling and the survey weighting? And just generally, do I think this data is worth looking at? So, for example, one that would be a survey of newspaper readers of a particular publication, because you know that that might have a very strong bias. And so, at a very basic level, and there's obviously a spectrum there. So, first of all, it's like, do I kind of trust the source, if you like? And that goes for polling, but that goes for all sorts of different academic pursuits as well. Is there a trend that's often useful? I think when you're looking at something particularly contentious or something on a big issue, like I'm sure we'll come to this, like Brexit or support for the major British parties, you kind of want to see which direction the wind is blowing, if you like. So it's one thing to say the parties are neck and neck, which they broadly are at the moment in the UK. But we know that the Conservatives have been falling in the polls and the Labour Party, the opposition, have been gaining. So it's interesting to look at that context. And then I think broadly beyond that, it's really about, so there's how the data is collected and is there a trend? But then I think it's really about how you interpret the numbers. And this is where it becomes a bit more subjective. I think there's two roles that a polling analyst will have. One is to, in my case, to collect the data scientifically and to make sure it's robust data and so on. But the other is to then interpret it and see what's important, what isn't important. Mm-hmm. How can we place that data within the real world? Because as with anything insightful, it only really matters if you you can say what it means for the real world. And to try to step back and take that horrible corporate word, but that sort of helicopter view of what's going on. And I think sometimes when you pause and take a step back, that's a good way to do things. So one very brief example, you look at the UK at the moment, and I think we're in the middle of a pandemic. That's obviously driving everything to do with public opinion. There's the Brexit negotiations, but there's also the pull of potential of Scottish independence. And I think those are the big macro things that are going on in the UK. And the opposition, the Labour Party, have a new leader this year too. Mm-hmm. So if you understand those things, you get the broad context of what's going on. But obviously to understand them in detail, you need to look at the detail.
Right. So one of the reasons I was so excited that you agreed to join is our conversation is to bring a comparative perspective to this podcast, right? It's focused mostly on Canadian public opinion. But as a former British colony, still member of the Commonwealth, we share a lot. But it feels to me, you know, looking at how
politics, even in the last decade, have played themselves out in the UK. And we look at Canada, you know, moving not completely in separate directions, but not really that closely aligned. Can you give us a sense of, you know, when you take a step back of all the years you've studied public opinion, political behavior in the UK, is there an essence of British public opinion? Like, how would you describe kind of what Brits are thinking about some of the big issues? And do you have a sense of whether it's aligned with other kind of advanced democracies, or is kind of Britain going its own way? What's your sense?
It's a very difficult question to see how aligned Britain is with other countries, simply because there is no uniform. I'm sure it's the same in Canada and elsewhere. There is no uniform consensus on a lot of things anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certain things there is consensus on. I mean, the royal family is typically very popular. I mean, there's always dissenting voices, but I think it's fair to say that the royals and the armed forces, things of that nature, tend to get very high approval ratings in the UK, even if in the example of the armed forces, you know, the public might have disagreements or strong opposition even to things like the war in Iraq, but there's still a reverence for the services, if you like. And I guess that's similar in many countries. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say what's kind of uniquely British, just because I don't think there's necessarily consensus on most things. I think if you want to take a step back and understand British public opinion at the moment, I think you have to look at it through the prism of what's going on right now, which is the pandemic. But then the traditional divides that you have between Labour and Conservative, but also over Brexit. And I think both of those, whilst they're not completely aligned, so it's not true to say that every Remainer votes Labour and every Leave voter votes Conservative. There are a minority of a minority of Conservative supporters are Remainers, for example, and similarly there are a minority of Labour supporters that are Leavers. So yes, so there are a minority of Conservative supporters that are Remainers, for example, and a minority of Labour supporters that support Leave. You know, I think that broadly speaking, what you see is this divide between on Brexit. So, for example, in 2019, we find that people are almost twice as likely to identify very strongly with their Brexit vote than they are the particular political party they support. So if you start from Brexit and the broad support for different political parties, I think what we see is there are big divides in this country, which I can expand on, by age, so generational, by sort of education, so whether you're a graduate or not, but also it's deeper within that too, whether you live in a city or a town or a rural area, and to an extent your housing tenure as well, so whether you own your own home or you rent and things like that. And in many ways housing tenure has been a consistent divide in the past too. So when you look at different sort of cultural or political views of different age groups, different educational levels of attainment, where you live, how you live and so on, it's quite then difficult, I think, to then sort of build up to say that there's a uniform a view of British public opinion. We're going through, I think this is fair to say, a very strong state of flux at the moment, have done in the last sort of 5 years. And what will be interesting to see is how these new alliances settle down, if they do, in the 2020s.
I guess in many ways, yeah, I think Brexit has come to define at least this era of British politics and just British identity, right? Like, I think historically, at least in my political science training, when we think of the UK, often politics and also public attitudes towards government and public affairs issues has been really class-based. Feels like, you know, Brexit has kind of thrown that up a little bit, right? And you saw, for anyone listening who paid some attention to the last British general election, you saw the, you know, Conservatives winning in constituencies in the north of England that no one, you know, probably 30 years ago ever thought the Tories could win. And in the same way that Donald Trump was winning counties and parts of the Rust Belt, Pennsylvania, that people thought the Democrats would never lose. So it does feel that Brexit was, or I guess the UK's place in Europe, if we want to even take a step back, was always an issue, but it really became the defining identity that people then built other opinions off of. Is that a good way to define it?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about Brexit, which there may not be a definable answer or a definite answer to this, is to what extent is Brexit the symptom or the cause of the divides that exist within the UK? I mean, the cheap cop-out answer, I think, is to say it's a bit of both, because I think the divides that Brexit sort of brought to the fore around some of those demographic splits that I've mentioned, and you know, some of the so-called left behind areas, old industrial areas, mining areas, mining towns in the UK that were always voting Labour on a class base, now suddenly supporting Brexit, and sort of, I wouldn't say uniformly, but some of them at least voted Conservative for the first time. You know, this is something that is partly driven by Brexit, but it's partly driven by those long-term declines in those areas, a long-term cultural divide between sort of your metropolitan elites, to use that phrase, that maybe are quite socially liberal, versus your sort of small town places that maybe still cling to sort of older school social values, shall we say. And Brexit exacerbated that. It showed the divides. And then because you had this one thing, how you voted Remain or whether you voted Leave, to cling to, which in many respects articulated all these nuanced cultural and political differences within these different demographic groups or different areas of the UK, then suddenly that sort of took over everything. And you're a Remainer or you're a Leaver, even, you know, to varying degrees, even if the issue itself is settled, at least in a sense that Britain has left and, you know, we were in the middle of a trade negotiation. So anyway, I mean, in conclusion there, I think what you see is that there are these long-term trends among some of these demographic groups based on cultural political change that Brexit kind of captured. But then once it did that, it's become the symbol of it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you shouldn't exaggerate it either. I think there is still a sense, like I say, that there are people that voted Leave that still vote Labour, people that voted Remain and still vote Conservative. But I think one thing we are seeing in the Western world, and I hate to be the guy that brings up the US on a Canadian podcast, but you saw that the Trump comparison is so good, really. It's hard to read across the two countries, right, sometimes, but you see those old industrial, quote-unquote, left-behind areas, without being too patronising, that voted for Trump. There is a parallel you could draw with similar areas in the UK that voted Brexit. Now, I mean, what you saw in the last US election is, at least to some extent, I mean, don't want to exaggerate this point, to some extent, those states, at a state level at least, there was a sense of a little bit of comeback. Maybe the Labour Party will see that in the UK, but I mean, that's a big question.
Yeah, well, and I was the first, just to clarify, I brought up Trump before you did, so you're excused. But I think, you know, if you use Brexit and Europe, right, it feels like for those that voted to leave, it also was a reflection of how they felt about Europe itself, right? Europe was that elitist, cosmopolitan, kind of, depending on your perspective, you could say condescending organization that told me how to think and how to act and what it meant to be European. And in the same way that kind of Trump rallied against the same kind of elites in society, you know, those that wanted out of the EU could point to Europe as, and European leaders mainly in Brussels as like that fall guy. So I think there's a lot of parallels. I think it's really interesting. We see a little bit of it in Canada. You know, there is an undercurrent of anti-elitism, of you know, in versus out. You know, we see it particularly with those that live and work in sort of the energy sector in Canada, and how, you know, part of the country is moving quickly to transition away from you know, carbon, and they're entirely dependent on it, and that's creating a particular divide. And so region in Canada has been one. You mentioned earlier Scotland. And, you know, I think there is a similarities between Canada, obviously, in the UK in terms of nationalism and sort of the subnational sort of countries that make up our collective kind of federation. You're not a federation, but you've kind of become one over the last 30 years. Maybe you could speak to the, from your vantage point, the threat of Scottish independence. You know, for those not listening or fully aware, there was a referendum about 6 years ago now. I remember because my wedding day was the 2 days after the actual vote.
6 years feels like a lifetime ago.
I know, yeah. Like it totally does. But you know, polling in the UK, in Scotland, sorry, is showing really for the first time a sustained level of majority support for independence. What explains sort of that, and maybe the whole Scottish question, why we don't necessarily see that in Wales, which is the other sort of, you know, national or the other country that kind of, you know, has its own devolved parliament, but doesn't have as strong an independence movement as we see in Scotland.
Well, I'll come to Scotland and Wales, but very briefly on Brexit, because I think there's an additional point to make, which is I talked at the beginning about there being a state of flux in the UK in the 2010s, if you want to call it that decade. There's a real period of change. I mean, at the beginning of the 2010s, Europe wasn't really a big issue for Brits. We have our Ipsos Mori Issues Index, which tracks what people volunteer in free-form terms. So we don't give them a list, we just ask people what are the most important issues facing the country. And Europe's, you know, it comes up every now and then in the past 30 years, but it's typically a fringe concern for the conservative right in the UK, based on kind of sovereignty and this idea of Brussels pushing Blighty around and that sort of thing. But I think in the 2010s, as the decade wore on, it became a symbol of something. And Nigel Farage's UKIP, and then later on Brexit Party after Brexit happened, very much tapped into this sort of left behind thing, anti-elites, as you mentioned, but also immigration. Immigration was a huge driver of the Brexit vote. I mean, it's a bit like when, I hate to mention America again, you could tell I'm married to an American, but like when they talk about, there's a great episode of The Simpsons when Apu's doing his citizenship test and they ask him about the Civil War. And he gives a really complicated answer, and he says, and they say, just say slavery. And he says, okay, it's slavery, and they stamp him and he's in. But the reason I mentioned it is because, like, there is an argument with the Brexit vote that it kind of all came down to immigration, and I think you could push back on that a little bit, and you should, but it was the issue that I think people that turned it from a fringe issue into something that a majority of the population would vote for, and then that's before you look at Brexit, because there's a long term issue where Britain, or England, I think you should say, English people don't tend to feel very European, but that didn't necessarily lead to the Brexit vote. I think some of the short term issues did. Anyway, I digress. But on Scotland, I think the key thing to remember is that Scotland voted overwhelmingly to remain in the European Union. I don't have the stat in front of me, but I think it's roughly by sort of 2-1 margin. But anyway, by a large margin anyway. And so that's created a conflict with Westminster, and the idea that Scotland's future and England's future are different. And I use England deliberately. I mean, England was the driver of the Brexit vote, of course. Wales voted leave too, but England is numerically just the biggest country by far. Overwhelmingly in the UK. So I think that although you're quite right to say no to independence, won 55-45 in 2014, you then had a big seismic change in 2016 sort of created this conflict. But what's interesting is that didn't necessarily immediately lead to a big surge in support for independence. I mean, there was a bit of one. But to give you an idea, going into the 2019 election, which was December 2019, Ipsos Mori, my firm, had support for Scottish independence at 50%, so 50-50. So whereas more recently, I think it was in October, we had support for Scottish independence at 58%, so wow. 58-42, which is the highest any polls recorded. Now, there are other polls out there that have the lead slightly lower, so we should acknowledge that. But you're typically finding very large leads to independence now. So if you can imagine almost 55-45 one way has become 55-45 the other way. So, I mean, Brexit's created that conflict. But I think the year with COVID can't be underestimated too. I mean, what you find is that Scottish people tend to have a very, very strong opinion of Nicola Sturgeon, who is the First Minister of Scotland. So if you can imagine, Scotland has its own parliament, which is a devolved parliament within the UK, which has a lot of power over domestic Scottish policy, but not total power. So it's, you know, it doesn't have control over sort of defence and things like that. But it's got a lot of power. And she's very, anyway, she's in charge of that. And the SNP have a strong control over the Scottish Parliament. The Scottish parliamentary elections next year, which they're expected to continue to win a majority in, even though it's a proportional system, which is, it's unusual to win majorities in those sorts of systems. So just for your listeners' benefit, what you've got is a very strong, popular leader of the SNP, which is the party that supports independence, in charge in Edinburgh. And they seem to have done a very good job handling the coronavirus outbreak. On the flip side, you've got, in Scotland at least, Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, is extremely unpopular. Absolutely horrific. I think we've got net ratings of something like minus 60. I haven't got the figure in front of me, but not just a bit unpopular as prime ministers can be, toxic north of the border. I say that as someone who's living in North London. So what you've got over this year, I think, is a sense that of maybe people moving towards, if Nicola Sturgeon's can manage this pandemic in a good way that I support, maybe independence isn't so scary. I suppose what we don't know is whether if things get back to normal, will that change? I think the reason you'd be sensible, I think, to be pessimistic about the future of the Union and Scotland's place in it would probably be because if you look at the age breaks on support for Scottish independence, it's only the over 65s that tend to be a majority in favour of the status quo. And the younger people are, the more likely they are to support yes. Now, we know with public opinion that things can change as you get older and that sort of thing. But I just think, given that the SNP are in charge in Edinburgh, they look, of course, for a majority in the elections next May, which they are saying will be a mandate for another referendum. And you've got this, the young people and the people that are really driving support for independence. It doesn't look good. Now, having said all of that, ultimately, an independence referendum is in the gift of Boris Johnson. He can just simply deny one. And that's what he said he'll do. And the question is that politically sustainable after next May's elections?
That's so interesting. And it's really fascinating how, you know, you said Brexit put the issue back on the agenda, but it's coronavirus and the obvious contrasting approaches to dealing with it that, you know, has probably, you know, the argument against independence is always the risk. Right. We have it here in Canada. We've had, two referendums in Quebec in 1980 and 1995. And the same argument for those that, you know, are arguing for unity are saying there's risk in going alone. There's risk in going alone. And that the same arguments were used, you know, Project Fear, I guess it was sometimes described, right, to describe Brexit. But it was also used during the Scottish referendum that if you go it alone, there's a lot of inherent risk in that. Well, in a way, Nicola Sturgeon can actually point to England and say, you know, Boris Johnson there's a lot of risk if we stay, if we had all our eggs in his basket, there would have been far more risk because of the way he's handled the pandemic. So really, really interesting.
And I think just to add briefly to that, it will be brief. I mean, I think part of it's emotional as well. And I don't mean that as a negative, but I just mean that connection with Westminster seems to be fraying. Mm. We tested some arguments in favour of independence and against, and the risk factor does tend to still come up with the arguments against that tend to resonate with Scots. There are issues around what currency would Scotland use, and when you start getting to the weeds of that, it becomes quite complex. But some of the arguments that resonate in favour of independence tend to be like Westminster just doesn't stand up for Scottish interests, and a general feeling that Scotland and England are moving in, you know, different directions, and it's that feeling that, you know, it's hard to fight back against, and there just isn't really. And the other thing to be aware of in Scotland is there isn't really a kind of obvious unionist, it's a big figure that you could see dominating a future no campaign. You certainly wouldn't want it to be Boris Johnson. I mean, you know, that Ruth Davidson is a former leader of the Scottish Conservative Party. She's very popular, or was reasonably popular in Scotland. She's kind of taken it, she had a child, and she's kind of taken a little bit of a backseat from Scottish politics at the moment, so it's not quite sure it'd be her. The Labour Party leader, who we haven't talked about, which is the new sort of Britain-wide Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer, who replaced Jeremy Corbyn. So he's the guy that's essentially tried to unseat Boris Johnson as the UK Prime Minister. He's got reasonably good poll ratings in Scotland, but at the same time, I mean, you know, not as good as Nicola Sturgeon. So it may be in a world where there's a change of government in Westminster, things could shift. We don't know if that will happen. I mean, I think the best bet for unionists, really, people that want Scotland to remain part of the UK, is to wait it out and delay as long as you can.
So I want to end our chat. You mentioned Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, and I want to end kind of there, because, again, our listeners probably didn't pay immense attention to the Corbyn era that lasted, you know, probably, depending on who observer you ask, longer than they thought it would, or maybe ended faster than it might have should. But, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, if you don't know, for the listeners, he was, you know, the former Labour Party leader. I think when he ran for the leadership, when Gordon Brown, oh, sorry, it wasn't Gordon Brown, it was Ed Miliband, right? Stepped down. He kind of ran just, you know, to put a more left candidate into the race, and a few people sort of signed his nomination forms, but really had no intention of supporting him. And he went on to surprise everybody, or I don't know if he surprised everybody, surprised me, by overwhelmingly winning that leadership vote. Looking at public opinion at that time, is it, you know, it was around the same time that the Brexit was happening. There was this churn, I think, this angst in the population. Does Jeremy Corbyn, does it make sense why he emerged when he did, given sort of the state of mind of the British public and what they were rejecting at times, and also what they were maybe hoping for in him? Or was he just simply the result of, you know, the base of the Labour Party basically picking somebody who, you know, the general public would maybe never accept?
It's a tricky one, because I think that Corbyn supporters would say, I think with some justification, that he was never, not never treated fairly, but he was often not treated particularly fairly by the media. And I don't think you have to be a supporter or an opponent of him to sort of see that. He didn't have very many friends in the so-called mainstream media. I think that's probably fair to say. We'll leave it at that. In terms of explaining his rise, I mean, it's difficult to attribute it to anything particular in British public opinion generally, simply because the pool of people that choose British party leaders is really small. I mean, even the Labour Party, which, I mean, there's some confusion at the moment about how many party members there are now. The party membership under Jeremy Corbyn grew a lot, but let's call it something in the region of 500,000 people. I'm not really very close to how many Labour Party members there are, and that's a lot for a UK party, probably more than the rest of them put together. But it's still a relatively small group of people that are choosing who that leader is. So when Jeremy Corbyn became Labour leader, I think there was a sense that the candidates to replace Ed Miliband were more of the same, that he had a very distinct kind of unapologetically left-wing message that resonated with the party membership. But then that doesn't mean it resonates with the country as a whole. Jeremy Corbyn was never particularly popular. He sort of oscillated between extremely unpopular. In our leader ratings, which we track back to when Margaret Thatcher was leader of the opposition, 1979, he actually achieved the worst net satisfaction rating of any leader of the opposition at one point, in that sort of 40-year or so history of us tracking it. So it gives you an idea. And then even at his best, which was shortly after his surprise election result in the 2017 British general election, where Labour didn't win, but they denied Theresa May a majority. So she stayed in office, but much more precariously than she was going in and expected to be. Even then, his personal poll ratings were probably net neutral, just as, so roughly equal numbers approving as disapproving. So he himself has never been a particularly popular man. Having said that, there are large aspects of his agenda which poll quite well. So nationalising, bringing sort of different areas of the economy into the public ownership, being anti-war, increasing tax on the rich to pay for public services, which maybe not be a new idea, but you know, these pro-environment policies, again, may not be new ideas, but a lot parts of his agenda were very popular, particularly among younger voters. But he himself could never really quite pass water as a credible prime minister in waiting. On the flip side, I mean, his replacement, Keir Starmer, who is going through something of a fight with Jeremy Corbyn at the moment over a row about anti-Semitism, which maybe we can expand upon briefly. Keir Starmer has very positive poll ratings. So I told you Jeremy Corbyn was never really in the plus, net positive range. Well, Keir Starmer's first poll rating was plus 31. So it was something like 51% satisfied, 20% dissatisfied. And plus 31 has never been beaten by a leader of the opposition in that same 40-year period. It's only been equaled by Tony Blair when he was an opposition leader. Now, just because Tony Blair went on to win doesn't mean Keir Starmer will. Tony Blair was a leader of the opposition when the Conservatives were deeply, deeply unpopular. And the Prime Minister at the time, John Major, was too. Whereas right now, I think you could describe the Conservative government as divisive, maybe leaning unpopular, but Boris Johnson not necessarily completely toxic. So it's a completely different time, a completely different context. But Starmer sort of comes across as he's that sort of lawyer of that white middle class lawyer of a certain age that, rightly or wrongly, maybe a bit of unconscious bias in there. Focus groups and the public tend to think, yeah, I see a prime minister there, but whether he makes it is a big, big question of the next elections, not for sort of 3 or 4 years.
And that's really interesting because, you know, in Canada, it's very rare for an opposition leader to be well known at all. Even Stephen Harper in the years before he became prime minister, most people in any polls would say, I really don't know him, right? But it is remarkable to me that very, relatively quickly, the British public get to know or seemingly get to know their opposition leaders, which I don't know if that's a function of the way the media report politics in the UK, give more attention.
Well, you should be careful, a little bit careful with it, because I think, I mean, certainly going into the 2019 election last year, so almost a year ago, actually on the 12th, Jeremy Corbyn at that time was extremely unpopular. The Conservatives won. Boris Johnson's Conservatives won on basically saying, we're going to get Brexit done. And so we're going to put it to bed. There've been lots of votes in Parliament about a withdrawal agreement. So the process of doing Brexit that had failed because of that sort of Parliament where the Tories didn't have a majority that I mentioned. And he was going, right, I'm going to put this to bed. I'm going to get Brexit done. And that was literally his campaign slogan, get Brexit done. But at the same time, he also pointed to Jeremy Corbyn and said, you don't want this guy to be Prime Minister, do you? And that helped the Conservatives win a big majority. Corbyn going and Starmer coming in, there may be, it's hard to prove, there may be an element to which the public didn't like Jeremy Corbyn in the end, saying, well, this guy isn't Jeremy Corbyn and he looks the part, so let's give him a chance. Doesn't mean he'll seal the deal. But yeah, like I say, we're years away from an election, so right. God, who knows what the fallout from COVID will be and Brexit will be. I mean, one of the things I say in a recent article I've written for Ipsos Mori is that, you know, if you look at the poll ratings of the Conservatives this year, they've gone up and down as satisfaction with the handling of the pandemic has gone up and down. But just because the poll ratings have fallen doesn't mean they'll stay fallen. As the vaccination comes out, as life gets back to quote unquote normal, maybe the government will see a bit of a boost in the polls, or maybe the economic hangover, if you want to call it that, from the pandemic will create problems that they can't resolve. I mean, that chapter's yet to be written, to be honest. But I think the big difference now for the Labour Party, the opposition, is that they've got a leader that at least for now passes the smell test with the public as a potential prime minister. And that's a plus for them. But whether it will bring them into office, we don't know.
Well, I agree. It's going to be, I mean, as issues change, so too can how people react to them. We see that all the time, right? The valiance and the salience of issues. You know, right now it's all about the pandemic, but 2 years from now, if it's in the rearview mirror, it may be a completely different set of issues that voters are being asked to evaluate their choices on. Well, Kieran, this has been really fascinating. I mean, we could talk for like 5 hours about the range of issues, considering what's happened in the UK, even in the last decade, is pretty remarkable in terms of, you know, the change in voting behavior, the change in some public opinion attitudes, and what it's meant for British politics. So thanks again for spending some time with us. It's been a pleasure. And for those listening, If you're interested in UK politics, I'm a kind of quiet nerd of it. I love it. Kieran's podcast is one that I listen to regularly. So I encourage you to tune in, and you can hear how polls and public opinion is shifting in the UK. So thanks so much, Kieran.
No problem. Glad to help.